Welcome to The Point. I'm Amy Vince in for Mindy Todd, and today we kick off the growing and gardening season with horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark. Hello, Roberta. Great to have you back.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here, Amy. Thank you.
It certainly is spring when we have you back on the airwaves. Listeners, Roberta is here to answer your gardening questions about trees, shrubs, perennials, vegetables, and also any garden pest question you may have. You can join the conversation at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626, or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. Roberta, before we look ahead to spring and summer growing, I want to look back at the snowy, cold winter we had this year. We had really cold temperatures for a period. We have two big snowfalls, which brought down trees and damaged many shrubs. Is there any special care we should be giving to smaller trees and shrubs that were damaged but we hope will survive this winter?
Well, you know, we have been spoiled for the past decade, and all of a sudden we had an old-fashioned winter again. It took us all by surprise, I think, particularly that last storm, which caused quite a bit of tree damage all across the Cape. Many of us have already had to deal with broken limbs and trees that needed to be removed. Some of us haven't dealt with them yet. But we also have just a ton of branches and sticks and leaves and all this stuff that came down. So I'm still in the midst of doing spring cleanup, and I expect many of our listeners are as well. The thing about broken woody plants in particular, just for an example, I had a lovely butterfly Japanese maple. It's a cultivar. I had planted it when it was quite young, maybe about 12 to 15 inches tall, and it was probably 12 to 15 feet tall by now. And it had formed a double crotch down near the base of the plant. That's where two main limbs come off at the same point. In retrospect, years ago, I should have correctively pruned one of those what became trunks off, because it created a very weak angle that when we had that heavy, heavy wet snow combined with high winds, the tree literally split right down the middle at the base. And I've read online people talking about situations similar to this, and many people say, "Oh, you can put a bolt in it, and it will, you know, grow back together." And I just like to say that's not true. That's wishful thinking. When you have major damage like that, yes, you can bolt it together, and for several years it may continue to grow successfully, but that's always going to be a weak point. There's always a crack. It doesn't grow back together, and water gets in there, and eventually you have rot setting in. So you're setting yourself up for future takedown of that particular tree, and I'm a firm believer in get the pain over with, you know, now, and plant something new. So my butterfly Japanese maple is no longer there.
It's gone.
I had it gone. Yeah, a friend's husband cut it down for me. Fortunately, it was small enough. I didn't have to have an arborist for that. One thing people can do is look around their yards and notice which particular plants perhaps are planted too close to the house, and I'm speaking from experience here, which particular trees may be more prone to coming down where it will cause damage to other things in your yard, particularly our old pitch pines. We lost a lot of those. We had several come down in my neighborhood. I had taken three down last spring, so I'm sure if I had left them, they would have come down in my driveway. So in terms of prevention, you know, go out there and look around and see what is potentially hazardous. For broken limbs, there's a number of good fact sheets on the UMass website, Cooperative Extension website, that explain proper pruning of broken limbs. You don't want to leave stubs or anything like that. And this is assuming a tree is small enough that you can do it yourself. Anything that's fairly large, you really should contact a certified arborist to do repairs or removal of large limbs. On smaller plants, on shrubs, perhaps that we can handle ourselves, it's a good time to get out there and remove anything that's broken. Take it right out at the base if it's a shrub or down to a healthy branch. You don't want to leave a lot of damaged plant material during the growing season. It's a great place for insects and disease to cause further damage.
And this does seem like a good time of year for that because things are already starting to bud out enough so that you can see what part of the plant is alive and what part just isn't going to make it.
That's absolutely correct. And I know one of the biggest concerns for many, many gardeners here on the Cape are, what do we do about our hydrangeas?
Mm-hmm.
And I have gone out and looked at mine. I have one area where another limb came down and pretty much squashed a really lovely plant. And so I have pruned that one back to live wood. It probably won't bloom this year, but that's, you know, something we just have to take into account. But the general principle for shrubs right now with damage is to take out things right at the crown if it's damaged badly, or prune it back to good wood. And that's something we can do ourselves for the most part.
With the smaller shrubs.
Yeah.
According to the state, Cape Cod is in a level 2 or significant drought. Nantucket is in a level 1 or mild drought, and the Vineyard is in the normal range, luckily for them. What plants could be most impacted by this ongoing drought? Because we've been in a drought condition, I think, since last spring or summer.
You're absolutely correct. The U.S. Drought Monitor puts out a weekly map. And you can find it online, and you can search it by state. So, and it's usually updated every Thursday. So every Thursday, I generally go online just to see where we are. And we haven't changed in almost a year. We are in what's considered moderate drought. I thought that we had sufficient rain and snow over the winter that perhaps it would alleviate that condition, but I'm wrong. We're still in a moderate drought. And as I work in my yard, I'm still in the midst of spring cleanup, which sometimes extends into summer for me. The soil is very dry. We have a lot of days where we get misty stuff. Yesterday we had less than a tenth of an inch of rain in where I live in Marston's Mills. Other areas of the Cape got a little bit more, but it's not significant. It's not really enough to change those conditions. So any shallow-rooted plants, obviously, are more likely to be harmed by prolonged drought. Plants that are in full sun that are not necessarily adapted to our particular soils, which tend to be droughty to begin with, are more inclined to be injured by things like that. So it's important to look at what plants are doing well and what plants maybe require more water, and think about maybe buying something new and replacing that, mm-hmm. you know, water-hungry plant with something that's more likely to survive dry periods and not require extensive watering.
Yeah, that leads into my next question, because I feel like this is the season when a lot of people are thinking about planting something. But given the drought conditions, we might want to skip it this spring and maybe wait till the fall?
Fall's a great time to plant. We usually do have more regular rainfall. It's hard to gauge what the season will be like. I mean, Cape Cod is, we're back and forth. You know, I love living here. I love the weather here. But you really can't always count on it being consistent. I mean, this morning it was 31 at my house. It's a little chilly. So we don't have what I would call a constant regular rainfall. It tends to be, over the past more than a decade, very erratic, where we tend to be going into a period where we have drier springs. And so planting in spring, if you have access to water, we're not under restrictions, then definitely you can plant and make sure those plants are well watered deeply until they become established. The whole thing about watering is you want to encourage deep rooting of all types of plants, and that's not done by watering 15 minutes every other day. Plants' roots will seek out water, so a good deep soaking once a week, maybe a little bit more when you first plant it, but as it becomes established, just once a week, a good deep soaking, so the soil is moistened at least to a depth of about 4 to 6 inches.
Right. I've heard you say that before, and I guess my question is how do we know? So it really is measuring, right? And maybe once you figure out how long it takes to get that deep soak, then you know what the timing is.
It is. And, you know, you can pick up a very inexpensive rain gauge at a hardware store, at one of our fine local garden centers, and put it out in the areas where you are planting and measure how much rainfall we get. And then also, you can measure what your irrigation or sprinkler system is putting out and figure out just how long you need to run it to top it up at about an inch a week.
Right. We're talking gardening this hour with horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark. If you have a question about plants, pests, or gardening, give us a call. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. For people who didn't get around to amending garden beds in the fall, is it too late to be adding compost and other things?
Oh, not at all. What I'm doing right now in my fairly extensive beds, they're not strictly perennials. They're a mix of perennials and shrubs and some trees. I raked up all the leaves that came down over the winter, and I have a leaf shredder that I bought a number of years ago. And I set it up. It's electric, so I have to run a line from the house. I set it up in areas throughout the yard and collect the leaves that I've raked together and run them through the leaf shredder. It's a great way to recycle your leaves instead of just hauling them off to the dump or hauling them off into the woods, which is what I used to do. And I shred all the leaves and spread them as mulch, sort of dual-purpose mulch and organic matter, on top of my beds. You can do the same thing with mulch or compost, a nice layer of some type of organic material over the tops of your beds. Helps them to helps the soil to retain moisture, keeps the soil a little bit cooler in the heat of summer, which sometime we hope will arrive, and is just a good way to use organic material.
That's a great idea. So do you do that in the spring, or do you do it this time of year?
I do it right now. I did it most of yesterday. I've got pretty much the front yard done. I still have my backyard to tackle, but that's on the list. We'll get to it. And I got it on Amazon, a Sun Joe leaf shredder, and it works really well. It's not terribly expensive, and it's a great way to recycle all those leaves that come down. You could do it in the fall. I wait until spring because I like to spread it out over my beds. I think it looks attractive.
Right. It looks like you're basically mulching with your
exactly.
with your organic matter from the yard. That's a great idea.
And you haven't had to buy it.
That's right. Container gardening for both flowers and vegetables is popular, but potting soil can get expensive. Is it true that you can reuse potting soil from season to season? And if so, should we be amending it or doing something to make sure it's useful again?
Potting soil is very expensive, and yes, I also reuse. I have a lot of containers that I grow mostly flowering plants, some vegetables as well. And I generally dump them out into my wheelbarrow and add some fresh soil to it so it's not 100% used up. And I will probably work in some Osmocote, which is a slow-release fertilizer, and then refill my containers and plant them with new plants every year. At some point, you know, after a couple of years, I'm thinking it's probably pretty worn out. And so I put it in the compost, which then after a year or so gets spread in my vegetable garden.
Oh, that's a great idea. Yeah, I'm thinking about doing that this year because it seems like potting soil, the prices just keep going up and up every year.
Everything is going up.
I know. We are talking gardening this hour with horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark. If you have a question or comment, you can join the program 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. I'm Amy Vinson from Mindy Todd, and we're kicking off the gardening season with horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark. If you have a gardening or plant question, give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. We've got Nancy calling from Brewster. Hello, Nancy.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks.
Very good. I am calling to ask you about the leaf mulching piece. Someone told me that oak leaves are very acidy and they shouldn't be put on a vegetable garden. Is that so?
That has not been my experience. I look at leaves that fall. I have a lot of oaks in my yard, and I look at them as a free resource. And if they're all shredded up and you mix them into your vegetable garden soil, it's a free source of organic material. If you are concerned about the pH of your soil, whether your soil is acid or alkaline, I would suggest just taking a sample to the Cape Cod Extension Service, the Master Gardener. Gardeners do soil testing for pH. I believe it's a free service, and it can tell you exactly whether you need to add something to counteract acidity, like limestone, or whether or not your soil is absolutely fine. So I wouldn't worry about whether the oak leaves are acidic or not. You can simply have your soil tested and then amend it if necessary.
Sounds good. May I ask one other question?
Sure.
I have an inkberry bush, which has been thriving wonderfully, but through the winter, the base of it, up for about a foot, is almost bare of its growth. And I don't know whether I should do some sort of pruning from the top to encourage more from the bottom. Do you have a thought?
Inkberry is a great shrub. It's one of our native hollies that is just a lovely, lovely plant to have. You often find it growing along the edges of the woods. However, because it does prefer to grow in a partially shaded locations, it sometimes just does lose the lower leaves of the plant, so it has most of its growth on the top. There's not a lot you can do to totally correct that. If it's growing in with more sunshine, you could prune it back from the top down to encourage more growth from the base. But that's about it.
Nancy, thanks so much for the call. If you've got a gardening question for Roberta, you can join the conversation at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626, or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Roberta, I just want to talk quickly, go back to the soil testing. Is this the right time of year to be getting our soil tested? And if so, is the turnaround time pretty quick in your experience?
You can get your soil tested any time of year. It because it does take some time for ground limestone to effectively change the pH of soil. It's generally thought that having it done in the fall is to be preferred, because that way you can apply your lime in the fall. And it has the whole winter into the spring to do that chemical reaction in the soil and make it a little bit sweeter, less less acidic. But I've always felt, you know, you do things when you have the time or the need to do it. And if you need to test your soil in spring, go ahead and do it. It's a great time to do it as well. I'm not sure what the turnaround time is. I expect it's not. I was retired from the Extension Service years ago, and it was pretty quick back then, and I'm pretty sure the Master Gardeners are on top of things. So I would imagine it would be a turnaround of certainly less than a week.
Right. So let's turn to the vegetable garden. Soil temperature is really important for crops. So what crops can we seed or plant in the vegetable garden at this time of year, and what should we be waiting on?
Well, you know, it's always funny. People on the Cape love to plant their peas on St. Patrick's Day, March 17th. I think the soil might have been frozen this year. Seeds germinate. Germination is a function of soil temperature and moisture. Some seeds germinate at fairly chilly temperatures. Peas will, but they'll take a long time. If you planted peas at the end of March, and if you plant peas this week, they're probably going to be germinating and growing pretty much at the same time. I'm not out gardening on St. Patrick's Day. The older I get, the less I like being out in cold weather. I'd rather sit in front of my wood stove. So peas are actually on my list to be planted this weekend, and I'm looking forward to that. Other things you can plant right now, the garden centers are getting in shipments of vegetable seedlings. If you like to plant from seedlings right now, you can go to your favorite local fine garden center and get all different kinds of lettuce, different kinds of coal crops, which include things like broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, collard greens. All of those can be planted right now, either from seed or from seedlings. Obviously, you'll have a faster harvest if you have a seedling to put in the ground. You can also plant spinach right now. In fact, spinach prefers to be planted now. And as it matures and the weather warms up, there's a biological signal that tells the spinach to bolt. So you want it in early so you can harvest it before real warm weather sets in. Bok choy is available in garden centers right now, and that's a great nutritious vegetable to grow in your garden, either from seed or seedlings. So we do have a wide range of onion sets or onion seedlings. Potatoes can be planted now. Lots to do in spring.
And for those crops that you're talking about, the lettuces and the, say the kales and the spinaches, do we need to put a cover over them if there's concern about frost, or are they hardy enough that they'll survive through a frost?
Those are hardy enough that that they will survive through a frost. I do use a cover over my things like broccoli and kale and members of that family, because there is the imported cabbage butterfly, that pretty little white butterfly we see flitting around our gardens in May. And so I have aluminum hoops, half hoops, that I put across my raised beds, and I put floating row cover, which is a fabric, very lightweight, flat fabric that sunlight penetrates through it, water penetrates through it. I put that over the aluminum hoops and tuck the sides all into the ground so it doesn't blow away, and that prevents insect pests from actually reaching your plants, and they grow quite happily. It also enhances the environment underneath that cover, so they do very well in situations like that.
Right, it's retaining the moisture and maybe a little bit of heat?
That's correct.
Right. And how long do you have to keep them covered for the pest control? Is that through the month of May or beyond?
Well, that white cabbage butterfly is around pretty much the entire season. So you can leave it on all season, or you can leave it on until they've gotten strong and they're growing quite nicely. But then you have to use something on them about every 7 to 10 days. I tend to use a material called spinosad. It is sold commercially under a number of commercial names. Probably the most common one is Cap'n Jack's Dead Bug, which is pretty funny. But spinosad is derived from a soil bacterium, and it affects the nervous system of insects. That nervous system that it affects is not present in mammals, so it doesn't affect us. It doesn't affect our dogs or cats. It doesn't affect birds. They're not mammals, but it doesn't affect them. It only affects insects, so it's a very safe product to use. However, because a bee is an insect, it will affect bees when it's wet. So we always recommend not to spray when the plants are in flower or when the bees are actively working in and around particular plants. But other than that, it's a very safe product to use, and it works on a wide range of insect pests. And any of the cabbage worms, that's a good product to use.
And I missed it. How often are you spraying?
Probably every 7 to 10 days.
And does watering or rain, you know, if you do that, do you need to apply it more often?
No, you don't.
Oh, that's good to know. I had success with that last year. I've been losing kale. It ends up just looking, just the veins
like
are left. Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. And I started losing that last year, and I had kale right through the season, which was fabulous.
Yeah, yeah. There is a second caterpillar pest that comes in a little bit later in the year, and it's called the cross-striped cabbage worm. It looks similar to the regular green cabbage worm, but it does have darker markings on its body, and it tends to come in later in the season, and so it's active right into the fall, which is when you want to be picking your kale, and if you do nothing, you end up with, like, very shredded leaves.
Yeah. Those pests, I tell you, it's a battle.
It is a battle. I mean, everything's got to eat, but just not eat everything.
Right. We are talking gardening this hour with Roberta Clark. If you have a question for her, you can join the conversation at 866-999-4626 or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. Annuals can seem expensive, but if we choose ones that will bloom through the fall frost, they can bring many months of color. What long-blooming annuals would you recommend for either in-the-ground or container growing?
Oh, there's such a wide choice. Actually, the beauty of annuals is that most of them do bloom the entire season. I know right now in spring, everyone is always attracted to the beautiful blue lobelias, the annual blue lobelia. That is a cool weather crop, and it looks wonderful in April, May, and early June. By July, it tends to peter out because it does not like hot weather. But things like verbena, things like, obviously, marigolds, one of my favorite, zinnias will bloom all summer. Impatiens will bloom all summer into the fall, particularly the New Guineas. I loved mine last year. There's a particular one I grow. It's one of the Sun Patients. I can't remember the cultivar, but it has a variegated leaf, dark green on the outside edge with a stripe of gold down the middle. And even if it's not in full bloom, it just looks lovely. And mine was blooming well into October. I mean, it was really quite nice. So most annuals, with few exceptions, will bloom right up into fall.
Yeah, and I think the marigold has been underrated, at least for me. There are so many new varieties with different colors. There's even a lime-colored marigold, and foliage smells so wonderful, and it blooms and blooms. And it seems like they're less interesting for pests. I don't get rabbits eating my marigolds.
The rabbits don't eat my marigolds. I'm people who have been listening to me for a long time know I have an ongoing battle with rabbits. This year, I am using the liquid form of plant skid, and I'm going out. I've already done it once. I need to do it again because more plants are up. Every year, rabbits nibble off the tops of my hostas as soon as they come out of the ground, and it just drives me nuts. And so I said, this year I am going to be proactive. So I've already done one round of liquid plant skid, on all of my hostas that are popping up, and that's also on the list for this weekend because there's a whole new batch of hostas that have come out of the ground. Rabbits drive me nuts, but marigolds are generally not bothered by them. Common folklore has it that they repel insects, but that's not 100% true. But I like them because they're lovely plants. They bloom all summer into the fall. And if you are into using edible flowers in your salads, marigold petals are wonderful to use in a salad.
Oh, I was just going to ask about that because I was thinking of nasturtiums. I know we like to add a few nasturtiums to our salad, but I didn't know that marigolds were also edible.
Yep.
Is the foliage edible and the petals?
I've never tried the foliage, to be perfectly honest, but I have used the petals and I've enjoyed them. I don't use a lot, but a few.
Just a little flavoring.
Little bit.
We're talking gardening this hour with horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark. If you have a question about plants, pests, or gardening, give us a call. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. I'm Amy Vince in for Mindy Todd, and we're kicking off the gardening season with horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark. If you have a gardening or plant question, you can join the conversation at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626, or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. We have got Maureen joining us from Aquinnah. Good morning, Maureen.
Good morning.
Have you got a question for Roberta?
I do, about jump-starting dahlia tubers. And I know there are a lot of different methods. I've pulled mine out of the cellar, and they're sitting in sort of a warm room, and I'm waiting to start to see the little nodes come out. Friends do different things. I have one friend who buries her dahlia tubers in her hot compost pile to sort of wake them up, give them a jump start. Over the years, sometimes the ones that I thought weren't viable, I've thrown into a bin that then collected rainwater, and lo and behold, they were viable and started sprouting. And I'm just wondering about the best methods. The ones that I'm waking up have been in a warm space now for 2 or 3 weeks, and I'm still not seeing anything happening. So I guess that they were really asleep this winter. But yeah, any other sort of well-kept secrets on getting them to start early and without potting them up yet until that I can see that they're actually viable?
Yeah, it's I like to get an early start on dahlias because they do take a long time to wake up. So if you can push them in a warm area, I find that it helps. I actually have these large, I guess they call them bulb boxes. They're just these black perforated boxes about 4 inches deep. And I do get compost out of my compost pile, and I put a layer of newspaper in the bottom, a little layer of the compost, and then I put the tubers in and cover them with compost and water them. I think it's the combination of moisture and heat that wakes them up. I have a little greenhouse I got at Job Lot. It's 4x4 and about, well, it's taller than I am, so it's taller than 5 feet. And I set it up on my deck, and I put the boxes in there, and it gets warm, really warm on a nice sunny day, even when it's cold outside. And I find that tends, for me at least, tends to get them started earlier. Otherwise, if you just wait until it's, you know, warm enough to plant them outside, you're really not getting a lot of good growth until, certainly not blooming until fairly late in the gardening season. So I think maybe moisture is also needed along with the warmth.
Some people have said that they soak them first just for a day or two before even doing sort of what you're doing.
Yep, I have heard that, and it seems to work.
Okay, great. Thanks for the pointers.
Thanks for the call, Maureen.
Thank you for the question.
Give it a try. Have a great day. Thanks.
Thank you.
If you have a question for Roberta, you can join the conversation at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. Roberta, I have raspberry plants that aren't as prolific. Each year they seem to be getting a little less prolific. And this year I did an early spring fertilizer for them. But do you have any other ideas on how I can rejuvenate them, or what I should be doing to better care for them to make sure that they stay healthy?
Over the years, over the years, have they the surrounding vegetation grown up so that they're more shaded?
Nope, not at all.
Okay. How do you prune them?
Well, that's a good question, because a friend has given them to me, and I know that there are two varieties that she has, and I can't remember which she gave me. There's one that you're supposed to prune back every year, and then there's one that you aren't supposed to prune. So I actually, this year, I have one section that I pruned and one section that I didn't, to see as sort of an experiment to see which ones do better.
Yes, and she's absolutely correct. There are the fall-bearing raspberries. If you don't prune them, you'll get a light crop in summer but a heavier crop in fall. So most people recommend just cutting them down in spring, because they bloom on new canes. Cutting them down in spring, letting them grow up, and you'll get a crop in the fall. The regular type of raspberry is what we call a June bearer, although it's actually July when they start bearing. And they bear on the the new canes as well. The cane that bore fruit last year basically dies. So you go out there and you make sure you're cutting out all the dead canes and thinning them out. You want the canes to be about 5 or 6 inches apart. And what do you fertilize them?
I did this year for the first time ever, because they were, again, they weren't doing so well. So
yep.
I did a very, and I think the package said do a very early spring and then a later
correct.
Spring fertilizer. Yeah.
Yep.
And is it too late now? So the section that I haven't pruned back, do you think I can just go ahead and lop those off?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Just, but you're not sure which is a fall bearer and which is a summer bearer?
I think these are fall bearers, because I remember it's usually after Labor Day where I feel like they're, you know, I'm picking raspberries every day.
Yeah, then go ahead and lop them back. Give them a good fertilizer. If you said you already done it, you might do it again in the summer, and you should get a better crop this fall.
Great. Thank you. Well, we have Kathy calling in from Harwich. Hello, Kathy.
Hi, good morning. Thank you
good
for
morning.
Taking my call. I have a question. I have a lot of bayberry in the back, and I'd like to actually transplant some of them rather than buying them to the side. Can I do that now? And are there any tricks to do or not to do with them?
You can transplant them now. Give them as generous a root system as you can physically handle. The more roots you can move them with, the better off they'll be. And don't fertilize them when you replant them, but do water them weekly so that they don't dry out while they're forming new roots.
Okay. Sounds good. Okay, great. Thank you so much.
All right.
Thanks for the
You're
call,
welcome.
Kathy.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
The number to join the conversation if you have a question for Roberta, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we do have an email here from Kathy, who says, "Hi, Roberta. I overwintered a hydrangea in my garage, and taking it out yesterday, saw it's covered with scale and is very sticky. How can I treat this? Thank you."
Oh, scale, that's the bane of my houseplant existence here. generally, overwintering them is tricky. I'm glad it survived. I had one that I overwintered in a pot in my basement, and it's now out in the little plastic greenhouse on my deck. It's only been out there a week, but I see no signs of life coming on it, so we'll see. I would use something like a horticultural oil or Neem Max, which is a cold-pressed formulation of neem that tends to be more effective than regular neem oil. And you want to cover the stems. I'm assuming it hasn't leafed out yet. Cover the stems with the horticultural oil or the neem oil, Neem Max, according to the label directions. And the oils tend to smother the scale. It's hard to know when it's working, because scale are not mobile insects, and so when they're dead, they look just like they do when they're alive. But after a couple of weeks, you could like take a soft cloth and rub off the stems, and that should take care of the majority of them.
Good luck, Kathy. We hope it works for you.
Yeah, I have a Meyer lemon, a variegated Meyer lemon that I overwinter indoors, and I noticed a couple of weeks ago there were ants, and they were all over the plant, and I took a closer look at it, and my Lord, it was just covered with scale. So it's currently also outside in the cold weather, and when I'll get around to it, I will deal with the scale. I have Nemax.
Yeah, good luck to you. Do you get fruit from your Meyer lemon frequently?
It blooms, but it doesn't really fruit. I don't have ideal conditions indoors for it, but I grow it because it has variegated leaves, so I'm growing it for its foliage more than its fruit. I did have a lime tree, and it produced a ton of limes over the winter, but it got so big I had no room for it, so I gave it away.
Oh, that's too bad. If you have a gardening question for Roberta, the number, we still have a few minutes left in the show, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626, or you can send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. Roberta, I want to ask you about tomatoes, because it seems like, you know, even if people don't consider themselves vegetable gardeners, people grow tomatoes either in pots
Absolutely.
Or in the garden. So first of all, what is your rule of thumb? It used to be around here that we would say can't put the tomatoes in until after Memorial Day because of frost. But I feel like with a changing climate, that date is moving. So when do you typically put your tomatoes in?
For the past, I'm going to say 5 years. Well, actually longer than that, but I've used protection over them. But for the past 5 years, even without using protection, I've planted my tomatoes roughly May 15th, so about 2 weeks ahead of the normal time. And I have, knock on wood, I've gotten away with it.
Right.
And I generally start picking tomatoes in early July rather than in August. You can use floating row cover. I mentioned that as great insect protection for your cabbages and your kale and things like that. You can also use floating row cover to enhance the environment and give frost protection. So if there are concerns about frost, that's a great way to alleviate it.
And in the
I think you can get away with doing it in mid-May.
Mid-May. And I've been putting mine in, I think, about the same time. And what I feel like what's damaged them more has often been a windstorm where
yeah.
they just get buffeted by, you know, we have some strong storm come through and, you know, they're,
yeah,
yeah, that takes them out a little bit. And then what, any new varieties or favorite varieties that you're going to be sure you, I know it's, there's so many out there, it's hard to limit ourselves. So if you're putting a cap on how many plants, what are the must-haves that you're doing this year?
I've gone from planting, about 44 to 38. And last year I said, this is ridiculous. I'm not going to do any more canning. And so last year I only planted 24. And this year I need to reduce that even more. But I always like to, I used to only plant heirlooms, but they are so prone to diseases when we have a wet season. So I've gone back to some of the improved hybrids, and Better Boy Improved or Better Boy 2 is one that I rely on as a great producer that is disease resistant. So it gets less blight, it gets less early blight as well as late blight, less anthracnose, less septoria leaf spot, and it has great flavor. There's a Whopper Improved that's a good one. I still plant the Japanese Black Trifelli because it has such unique flavor. That's kind of an heirloom, not terribly disease resistant, but just great flavor. And I'm always I plant too many cherry tomatoes, so I want to cut back on that this year too.
I have to have the Sun Golds. Those are my
yes.
absolute favorite.
Yes, I love Sun Gold. I also, in some years, if I can find it, I will plant one called Sun Sugar. It looks very much like Sun Gold and is almost as sweet, but it doesn't crack.
Yes, yes. So, and is the cracking just uneven watering? What is causing?
Yes.
Is that what it is? Okay.
Yeah. it's basically the tomato, the little tomato grows faster than the skin does, so it cracks.
Right. All right. Well, we have another call. We have Tor calling in from Orleans. Good morning, Tor.
Good morning. I'm sorry I didn't get your name.
Oh, I'm Amy, and I'm with Roberta.
Yeah, well,
good morning.
Thank you. Amy, good morning. And Roberta, I have a question regarding, since I'm a butterfly gardening advocate, I'm wanting to trace, have you seen any signs of your giant swallowtails? Because we can plant rue in the garden to attract their caterpillars, so we can trace the northward flow of a migrating exploratory butterfly trying to find habitats here in the Northeast. It's more characteristic of citrus groves in the South. And the giant swallowtail is the largest of all our swallowtails. It's brown and yellow banded, and it's a joy to see it as it explores northern habitats. So the question then goes, at nurseries like Sylvan Nursery out in Westport, they have found that rue is a favorite for the caterpillars. And of course, they love purple loosestrife, and they love other, let's say, perennials and zinnias too, and even bergamot. So have you had any encounters with this beautiful butterfly called a giant swallowtail?
I get the bright yellow tiger swallowtails, and I get the blue swallowtail and the pipevine swallowtail, but I don't recall seeing a giant swallowtail. And I do plant rue simply because I think it's a beautiful plant. So I haven't been successful in attracting it.
Yeah, Roberta, I understand that there are several forms of rue, and that people now know in the nurseries that you want a special kind that attracts a swallowtail who will lay eggs on the rue for their caterpillars. And it's a joy to watch them go through metamorphosis. So I'm going to try to find out just which rue is the one that's desirable for the giant. And hopefully that we'll see it when it comes flitting through.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, send us an email, Tor. Just send it to thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we can add it to the web post. Thanks so much for the call. And Roberta, speaking of planting for pollinators, particularly if you do like seeing those butterflies, what are some other plants that, I mean, do they just enjoy all flowering plants, or as we're saying, are there particular species of plants that we should be paying attention to?
Well, you'll find butterflies on a lot of different plants, but some of them are much more restrictive on what they will lay their eggs on. Mm-hmm. For example, the monarch, which everyone loves, really only will be laying its eggs on members of the milkweed family. I plant a lot of swamp milkweed, which is also sold as a perennial in garden centers, and it will seed itself in your garden, so you will have a good supply of it from year to year. And that's what I find my monarchs are reproducing on. But in terms of what they'll feed on, I find monarchs on a whole bunch of different flowers getting nectar, but they only will lay their eggs and complete their life cycle on members of the milkweed family.
Right. And I think maybe I have some of that swamp milkweed, and there's a section of our yard that we do not mow. We leave it sort of like a wild meadow. And
nice.
Yes. And it's not only do we see a lot of monarchs, but the bees, once those.
Oh, yeah.
I've never seen so many bees in all my life. When that milkweed is blooming, it's incredible.
Yeah, it is. It's really lovely. There's a whole ecosystem surrounding milkweed. There's a milkweed bugs, and there's a milkweed beetle, all of which require, the milkweed to complete their life cycle. So it's really fascinating to watch how interdependent some species of insects are with certain types of plants.
Well, the hour is over. Horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark is with us the third Tuesday of the month during the gardening season. And thanks so much for being with us. Roberta,
my pleasure, Amy.
We will talk to you next month.
All right. Bye-bye.
I'm Amy Vince in for Mindy Todd. Thanks so much for listening.